Welcome back to Techtopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. In this show, we have Vitalik Golom. He's an investor and author. This is Techtopia. This episode of Technotopia is sponsored by CheapTranscription.io. CheapTranscription offers 10 cent per minute transcription using our happy robots or 85 cents per minute using our human assistants. CheapTranscription.io is cheaper and faster than everyone else. CheapTranscription.io. This episode of Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter.plus. Typewriter.plus is a full-service editorial agency that brings amazing editors from places like the New York Times and TechCrunch to work on your writing. Need a blog post, a white paper, a presentation? The Typewriter team can write or edit anything on nearly any topic. Visit them at typewriter.plus for a free quote. That's typewriter.plus, typewriter.plus. Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Vitalik Golom. He's managing partner at GS Capital. Vitalik, how you been doing? Vitalik, we've known each other for a number of years, and your wit on Facebook and all the other places is fairly legendary at this point.
Yeah, my private Facebook page.
We try to keep it private.
Yeah. It's been interesting. I think it's like a little preview of house arrest. I think I'm pretty productive. You know, I work out of my home office most days, and I have a home gym, so. You know, all I do is work and work out, so it works okay.
You must be looking very healthy right now.
You know, I'm not eating out, and you know, getting that six pack back. It's not bad.
Yeah,
not the worst thing. See? I think it's changing habits.
Yeah, it's changing habits. Okay, so that's actually a good question. What happens after this whole pandemic thing? Do we go back to our old habits? What changes?
You know, it's interesting. I like many people, read all these books about habits and how to do good things and be mindful and all these things. You know, it takes something like 16 times to do something to build a habit. And you're going to see, I think a lot of people really kind of focus and come out of this much healthier mentally and with better habits. And then, of course, you're going to see people that just eat away the pain and maybe not such good habits. So. I'm hopeful. I don't know.
So you think this opportunity, this long span of time, is going to building? Like, I'm doing yoga pretty much every day and running. My wife's running every morning, just because there's nothing else. You really can't walk anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. But do you think we're going to be running every morning? You think you're going to be down in the home gym? You think you're going to stop eating out?
Well, I mean, I'm probably not the best person to kind of look at for this because I work out every day, almost every day for years now. But I think for a lot of people that, you know, this is an opportunity for them to get into the habit. And that's pretty cool because a lot of people have these things on their list that they'll never get to. But now they're sitting there idle. Hopefully they still have an income. But they're able to sit there and do things and kind of focus. You know, after a couple of weeks, people get over the initial shock and start thinking, okay, what do I do now with my time? And interesting thing is this kind of going around is that people are starting to realize that only 2 or 3 hours of real work gets done in an office. a lot of politics happen. And, you know, you got the commute, you got the long lunch, eating out, spending money, probably making unhealthy choices. All those things have evaporated and all of a sudden people are super productive. Of course, that doesn't, you know, work for people in the service industry. I mean, that's just what they're going through right now is atrocious. I don't know. But it's also a preview, you know, talk about the future here to get on topic. You know, it's a preview of what's going to happen with automation. A lot of these service people that are finding themselves to be non-essential, this is kind of a trial run for AI taking over a lot of these things that can be automated. So. You know, Andrew Yang was right, 100%.
So what does that mean? So let's look at this from a human standpoint, just two dudes talking, and then also let's talk about this from an investor, high tech investor standpoint. Are you excited about the opportunity for automation to destroy these jobs? Pretty much. I mean, they've already been destroyed anyway, and. What happens when we come out the other end of this? Do we have enough technology to A, replace a waiter at a restaurant, and B, replace that waiter's income with something superior?
I mean, anybody with any kind of objectivity that reads Harari and the like and really looks at the big picture of where we are, you know, it's really easy to get complacent, get narrow-minded and think, okay, this is our reality. This is all I remember. This is how I grew up. But if you look at history a little bit further back, the world changes quite a bit all the time. And there's no reason to think that, you know, things are, you know, kind of relatively stable, relative peace after World War II, UN, this and that, here's a world order. There's no reason to think that that's going to stick around, right? People have taken that for granted. So when, you know, automation started rearing its head, you know, I started paying attention to it as a tech investor. I was a corporate investor at HP Tech Ventures. And a few years back and started really talking about this publicly, like, look, guys, it's coming. The technology is there. You can automate things. You can make things cheaper. And naturally, capital will flow to these companies. There will be investment. They will come on board and they will start taking away jobs. And it's not going to happen over, you know, it's not going to happen one day overnight. It's going to boil the frog. And we need to start looking at what happens next. I think my solution is really about education. You know, we need to raise the education level. If you look at American or Western education in general, high school really only became a required part of education in America in the last Industrial Revolution, right? When we had the luxury of you know, kids not having to go to work, and we needed more educated skill sets and kind of the mass being more educated. I think the bar is rising yet again, where at least a four-year college education is really a minimum requirement for future generations to be able to make a living, to do anything productive that's worth paying somebody for their time. And that's the reality of it. I mean, we're talking about drivers. Retail is, you know, Amazon is really going to consolidate its gains now, given that everybody's switching to e-commerce, right? Obviously, with the shutdown, retail is really struggling. You know, a lot of things are going to change, and this is just an accelerating function, really.
And but as a person who you've probably done some waitering, you've probably done some I don't know, odd jobs here and there. As somebody who knows that at some point in your life you're going to have to go be a waiter, at some point in your life you're going to want to make a pizza, and maybe you stick with that for your career, or even to be a nurse, where you have a robot that can basically turn a comatose patient automatically. They have those in Japan where they have sort of assistance for the elderly. How do we fix that from a human perspective? How do we repair people emotionally from losing their necessity?
I don't have an easy answer for that. I mean, if you look at the last transition, the last two industrial revolutions, they really transitioned over the course of three generations in each case. And it was a lot easier because the pace of change was slower. So grandpa could retire and the son would take over. And then the grandson would take over doing something grandpa could never imagine. But this is actually happening now in the course of one generation. I think we're kind of like halfway through it. We really launched into it with the beginning of the mobile. You know, if we look at it from technology eras, the mobile era was really launched with the iPhone, right? With the first real smartphone, real internet in your pocket, all the world's information in your pocket device, that opened up a whole new world of opportunities. And that's 2007 when it launched and really got going around 2009, 2010. So we're a decade in. I think the next decade is going to be all about AI, being the AI era, and automation changing like an order of magnitude more industries, right? We're talking about you know, the merger of digital and physical worlds now, where we're digitizing certain functions in the physical world to a certain extent. So that transition is happening relatively quick. It's in the prime time, prime productive years of the millennial generation. That's why millennials are so affected by this. And then you stack on top of this, you know, climate crisis and all sorts of other things. That is a lot of economic pressure. We're already starting to see socioeconomic connections and governments, you know, really kind of failing and trying to catch up. I'm heavily involved with advising Ukrainian government on trying to kind of keep a hold of its generation of intellectual people, so that they don't have brain drain kind of people leaving. Ukraine is kind of back up for a second. Ukraine is very well known now as a kind of number one source in the world for in software engineering talent and some other disciplines. And the biggest problem there is brain drain, right? The country is, you know, beautiful and everybody loves it. And there's a lot of sense of identity there, especially after the revolution. But it's very difficult for world-class people to self-actualize there. They end up getting on a plane and leaving as much as they love their country. So we're trying to figure out ways to give them opportunity to stay there. And anyway, you look at, you know, developing countries, and this is even more acute.
Is the, and talking about brain drain, this is something we've talked about as we traveled. Is there any reason why we should prevent brain drain? Why should we prevent the flow of intellectual capital from one, or a place where it's not appreciated, to a place where it is?
I mean, we, I guess it depends on the question on who we are and you know, what team we identify with. So mm-hmm. if the team is, you know, I was born in Ukraine, I grew up in Silicon Valley from the age of 8, so I'm a little bit of a mutt here. But you know, for people that are trying to keep their countries from going broke or getting up, you know, they want an advantage, they want to get up and going. You know, those countries certainly want to prevent brain drain, because those are the most talented people. I mean, the ultimate brain drain, if we really have to talk about it and think about it, is the slave trade, right? The slave trade took the strongest of a whole continent for hundreds of years and moved them around the world. And been reading a bit about this, but you know, if you think about why hasn't Africa really come online, you know, much like Southeast Asia, etc., in recent decades, it's going much slower. I think that's a big part of it, is that there was kind of this kind of institutional brain drain, so to say, and the population way back was decimated to the extent to where, you know, it's so far back that it's taking so much more to catch up for them. So, you know, that might be a kind of an extreme example, but definitely top of mind as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that a place like Ukraine can, how does a place like Ukraine compete in the global marketplace of ideas, in the global talent marketplace? What's the best way to do it?
Well, Ukraine, what it has is kind of remnants of the rigorous Soviet educational system. It's not at the same quality, honestly, these days, but still you have half the college graduates coming out with hard sciences degrees. And that's something very unique. And the population is either the or one of the most educated in the world, basically percentage of college graduates to the whole population. So there's that's where it all comes from. It's not magic mana from the skies. So it's pretty easy to explain. But what Ukraine has is, you know, low cost of living, a relatively good lifestyle, great culture, mixed culture. So that keeps people interested. That's kind of a personal lifestyle choice for a lot of people. But if they want to make it rich in the tech world, there's not enough investment, certainly. All those things still need work. So that's what I would say is the trouble there. And the way to do it, the way we're trying to fight it, is create mechanisms of financing and letting those companies stay there longer, so they don't have to get on a plane as soon as they need to get any real investor.
So let's extrapolate that out to the U.S. How do we turn like a place like I don't know, the Rust Belt, something like a Flint, Michigan, or a Morgantown, West Virginia? How do we turn that into a intellectual powerhouse?
Really, the only way is education. If you look at the book Startup Nation about Israel's journey, there's a really interesting section there about the education system and the colleges. So they'd be able to attract world-class academics, create world-class academic institutions around them. That's the way to do it. So when we're talking about the Midwest, we're talking about the center of the country, where you have essentially a brain drain, population drain to the coast, to the big cities. That's a trend. It's very difficult to retain people there. I had an interesting debate with somebody recently saying that, oh, you know, now with this outbreak, everybody wants to get out of the cities and go to the country. But statistics show us that long term, you know, the urban centers are growing, not shrinking, and there's kind of a flight to that. Way back when, you know, after World War II, when gas was cheap and everything else, people were able to move out of the cities that were kind of middle class and above, and be able to get more land, have a more kind of relaxed lifestyle. But now people want to be in the cities. They want to be in the center of it all. And also Scott Galloway was recently talking about a really interesting kind of phenomenon. His thesis is that the big name brand educational institutions will team up with big tech, like Google and MIT, et cetera, to create degrees that are much more productive versus like academic. So the question, kind of coming back to the question of what do you do with Rust Belt societies that are kind of decimated with manufacturing leaving, with industry leaving, and incomes being decimated, and then people being forced to move to the cities? I mean, the answer is I don't really know, except for rising the standards of education level countrywide, which would give them a chance to be competitive. You know, they're paying the same taxes, they're getting the same benefits, they live in the same country, but they're in a different reality from the coasts where all the action is happening. So I think education, I mean, it all comes back to just demanding a higher level of basic education as being standard. And that's only something government can mandate once again.
What does the world look like in 20 years when you're done with it?
The world in 20 years, well, I think we have a couple of different trajectories, right? It all depends really on what we learn in the next 6 months, maybe. You know, on the one hand, we can finally snap out of it and become less primitive about the way we look at the world, right? I think, you know, again, kind of coming back to Harari, religious people are a little bit arrogant in the sense that they think that they know, they have all the answers, and they were written in a book a couple of thousand years ago. But scientists are very modest and think that they don't know anything and they need to go out there and find the answer. I'm definitely much more on the latter side. And I think if society starts looking without rose-colored glasses and kind of pushing problems off and trying to solve things and not get into crisis to crisis to crisis, but actually start looking ahead and think and understanding what's coming, like automation, like changes in economy related to that, need to start solving those problems. And hopefully we have leadership. I'm going to write a little bit about this myself. I need to put some more thought into it. But I think we need the type of leadership now that is, you know, less about playing politics and pandering, but more about identifying specific problems and building a plan to solve them. And that will give us fantastic growth. And projections, you know, from that perspective are that the world economy will double in the next 20 years. And that means a lot of opportunity for everybody, right? We'll be a wealthier world because our population is not going to double in 20 years, but our economy will. So that means it's going to create more wealth, more opportunity for people. So even though for a lot of people with lower education, kind of, it's going to be very difficult because they're going to get, they're going to have to shift, they're going to have to make moves, and many people won't be able to. I think overall, my outlook is very positive. We just have to get through this transition period without the alternative path, right? If we look at Back to the Future 2, where we have this alternative history, the alternative history might be Mad Max, right? We might completely devolve into a society where we have the haves that, you know, build walls around their towns, and the have-nots, which are, you know, turning into primitive animals hunting for food again. So I hope it's the first scenario, not the second. So we'll see.
What's your bet on what's your bet on either scenario? What do you think humanity is going to be able to pull off?
I think it's going to be some combination, but closer to the first. Humanity seems to, at least, you know, in the last couple of thousand years, seems to find a way eventually towards the right answer, as soon as we've tried all the wrong ones. But I think we're headed in the right direction. It will be interesting to see again how we recover from this and what lessons from this pandemic, which affected the entire world, will imprint on the way people look forward. I think one really important, really interesting thing is that people have finally learned the definition of the word crisis. And when somebody says climate crisis, I think everybody is going to pay just a little bit more attention. Maybe that'll be enough to get us in the right direction.
Fascinating. All right, dude. Where can people find out more about what you're working on?
So I run GS Capital. We're a boutique investment bank in Silicon Valley. We help companies raise capital. We help companies sell themselves. I happen to work a lot in transportation and mobility. So that's the future of transport, EV, and autonomy heavily. So on the ground, in the air, on water, all sorts of great companies there. That's my primary area. And I do some musings and writings on my own. My website, golem.net. By the time this is out, there'll be a new version of it out there, hopefully with that article about where I think we're going in the future.
All right. Sounds great. All right. Thank you, Vitaly. Thanks for joining us on Technotopia.
Thanks, John.
This has been Technotopia. I'm John Biggs. We will see you next week. Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.